good evening. Since I've taught Shlomo before, so I'm afraid that I might reuse some of my material, but this is certainly brand new. I don't think I've ever taught this before, so it may not be good, but we'll give it a shot. The question is, what's that?
We're talking gracious.
So repetition's not such a bad thing. hopefully we see something new in it every time that we approach it. You know, it used to be once every 3 years. Maybe that's because people got bored less faster. I'm not sure. Okay. So just taking a look at where we were, we established the idea of the validity and sense, to a certain degree, the validity of the rebellion.
I'm sorry.
I wasn't paying attention.
Okay,
I should have said.
Right.
Right. Oh, is this
it's
that
safe? No, but I think I'll take a safe one.
What's that? Is that a seat?
Oh, yeah, that's a safe one.
Okay.
Yeah. No.
Okay, so we established the the validity of the rebellion from Adoniyahu's standpoint, Adoniyahu being the oldest. We established that Shlomo was not going to play that game. Shlomo was actually in threat of death, which was an indication that Adoniyahu was not the kind of leader that was acceptable for kingship, that he was a thug, essentially. And being a thug, he has, even though he's the oldest surviving son of David, he has no right to rule. That was Shlomo's contention. And the more important contention was that we had this battle of the pro-Adoniyahu group versus the pro-Shlomo group. The pro-Adoniyahu, and it splits down the middle. You essentially, the Nevi'im, as far as we know, all go for Shlomo, which shouldn't be a surprise, because they received the Nevuah that Shlomo was the Yadid Hashem. He was called Yadidya, the loved one of God. The military, though, breaks down the middle. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, you said Shlomo's contention is this and this and this. But as I recall, Shlomo says nothing in here. He just, he's a kid still?
Well, that's the question. And the question is, how old is he? I don't think he's as young as most people think he is.
I don't know, I thought he was 11.
I think, well,
so
we'll
regardless,
see.
Regardless, he doesn't seem to be an active player here. It's all Batsheva and...
He is a passive player, and the reason why that is as we said, Natan was in charge of selecting who would be in line. That was his criticism. You selected somebody without telling me, and that's what we saw last time. Batsheva, we'll find out, has much more power than even she knows. And we'll find out exactly what that is as we go along. That's going to be towards the issue of why did Batsheva want to set Adoniyahu up with the Shunamit, the pretty woman. So we have to see exactly what Batsheva's place is. You could argue, however, that in this sense that Shlomo is very passive until he gets a blessing of wisdom later on. I suspect, though, that it could be one of those things where it's best if you have somebody to nominate you rather than you try nominating yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the argument that's being made here. But ultimately, it's really the Navi who has to decide who's going to get the nod, and it's the Navi who's going to decide if somebody is a God-fearless, is a man without fear of God. And that's something that Natan really had to say probably better than Shlomo. Shlomo is no Geah B'davar. He, you know, that's his brother, and obviously he's interested in the power. But to have another person who theoretically is not directly, you know, theoretically Natan would have been the Navi either way. Theoretically, I'm not so sure. Theoretically Natan would have been the Navi either way. So he has nothing to win or lose except for a real faith in that this is what God wants. So I think the message is more powerful coming from Natan. The reason why it's powerful coming from Batsheva is, as I said, the question was Batsheva kosher or not?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the statement that's trying to be made here. Batsheva is kosher, and therefore the produce of their relationship, the product, not produce, of their relationship is equally kosher as opposed to pasul. And that's important for Batsheva to say. But we'll find out. Batsheva has more power, much more power, than we generally give credit for, more than she knows. Because this idea of Malchut is brand new, and there's something going on with Batsheva that we're not aware of yet, but we will be as we go on. So as I was saying, did I answer your question okay? Why doesn't Shlomo choose for himself? So first of all, it could be partially immaturity and youngness.
There's no indication that he...
When I said that it was Shlomo who knew it, I would have been better off saying that it was Natan and Batsheva who were making that statement, that Adoniyahu, who is a big thug, which we knew anyway because he's painted how. He's painted as an Absalom wannabe. As soon as he's painted as an Absalom wannabe, it's so clear that he's painted as an Absalom wannabe. But of course, that's by the author of the book, who's a Navi. Obviously, it wasn't so clear back then who to vote for, Democrat or Republican. It just wasn't, you know, there were no big signs coming out of the sky that says vote this way or vote that way. It just didn't happen.
Was there also a question of self-preservation? Not that
would have been recognized by Adonoyo.
Yeah, he was. Natan was excluded from the party, and therefore one suspects.
Right, and so was Shlomo. So,
I think it was clearly because of Natan's leaving. If Natan would have come and said, I think you're right, you're the one, Hashem told me you're the one,
right,
he would have been welcomed with open arms.
But I was actually sort of drawing back. When I said Natan is not involved whatsoever in the decision, he has nothing to win or lose, that was not entirely a true statement. Because if Adoniyahu didn't really want Natan because he was a Shlomo leader, then Natan would have been out of there. So you could argue that Natan was as much an interested party as Shlomo was. However, you could also argue by the fact that theoretically prophets are they don't play their own game. They play God's game. Theoretically, they're neutral. And therefore, if Adoniyahu excludes Natan, the recognized prophet, you could argue that that's also an exclusion of God. So even though Natan was involved in this thing, the very fact that Natan is not invited to the party and therefore is theoretically at risk proves the point, even though Natan is directly involved. But your point is still there. Natan has something to gain and lose as well, and so does Bathsheba, obviously, although Bathsheba, again, doesn't even know how much she has to gain and lose yet. She'll find out soon. So back to the military. The military split down the middle. You have Yoav, who is a very unclear player. We're not going to deal with Yoav this week, God willing, we'll deal with it the next time we meet. Exactly whether he's a good guy, a bad guy. He's so all over the place, I can tell you that Chazal themselves don't know what to do with Yoav. They don't know whether he's good or bad. The Gemara goes back and forth. It ends quite ends off unsure.
No, David's pretty sure.
What's that?
David's pretty sure.
David's pretty sure, but he never did anything about it in his life, so the question is why. The question is why. And the question is why could he send Shlomo to do something that he wouldn't do himself, and that's something we're going to analyze.
But he has actually a whole list of what Shlomo is supposed to do.
That's correct. And Yoav is one of the people who's on his dead man's list. But the question is, if it was so clear that he deserved to die, then why didn't David do it himself? Was David less politically powerful than Shlomo was? Hard to argue. Especially in the first year of Shlomo's rule, is it really that David is less powerful, less in position to kill off his people that he feels deserve the death penalty? And the question is, does Yoav deserve the death penalty or not? And that's a question we'll get to next time we meet. What I wanted to address here, actually, is something that people generally don't analyze so much, but actually is sort of interesting from a Jewish historical standpoint, which is the Kohanim. If we take a look at the Kohanim, let's see who's on whose side. So in Pasuk, let's see who's invited to the party. Pasuk Zion, chapter 1, verse 7. Vayu dvarav im Yoav, so Adoniyahu had words, it's not really words, it means he had a pact with Yoav, who is the general. V'im Evyatara Kohen, Vayazru Acharei Adoniyahu. They supported Adoniyahu. So essentially, Evyatara Kohen is on, we'll see who he is soon. Evyatara Kohen is on Adoniyahu's side. V'tzadok HaKohen, Uvnayahu Ben Yoyada, V'natan Navi, Ushimi Rei, Agiburim Asher David, Lo Hayuim Adoniyahu, they were not with Adoniyahu. We don't know exactly who they're supported by right now, but they certainly don't like Adoniyahu. We could assume that they were pro-Shlomo. So we have here two Kohanim, Evyatar and Tzadok. What's that?
Benayahu
is a general. Benayahu is a general. Ben Yodaya, we'll find out later that he's in charge of what's called the Kreti and the Pleiti. According to Chazal, they were the Sanhedrin, but the simple read is that he was in charge of something like the honor guard. The honor guard, sort of like the, not exactly secret service, but the chosen soldiers surrounding the king.
None of the other brothers were vying for power, were they?
None of the other brothers that we know of were vying for power. All the other brothers supported Adoniyahu. All the other brothers, when the party takes place, all of the other brothers except for Shlomo with Adoniyahu, I think they appreciate the fact that Adoniyahu is the oldest and he gets the nod, and Adoniyahu certainly has the power base. I don't think the other brothers are in a position to play a game. Only Shlomo is in a position to play a game because he has support. So the question is, who is Evyatar, and who is Tzadok? And it's actually significant who they are and why they are sort of called upon at the time. So let's just do a review of who I'll read you Radak on Adoniyahu and on Evyatar. I'll read you the Radak. Pasuk, what Pasuk is that? Zion? Malachim Aleph, Perek Aleph, Pasuk Zion. Radak is Rabbeinu David Kimchi. His father was Rav Moshe Kimchi, was a famous grammarian. who really introduced grammar to the Ashkenazi world, in a sense. And Rabbi David Kimchi is in many ways considered sort of the Rashi for Nevi'im and Ketuvim. People look at him even faster than look at Rashi. He's considered the parish of choice for prophets and for Ketuvim. Mm-hmm. For Chumash, he's lost. That's the unfortunate part. Radak actually does exist on about half of Bereshit, but the books were lost. He wrote on all of Chumash, but his books are simply lost. We have him for the first maybe 10, 12 chapters of Bereshit, and then he disappeared. No, much earlier. He lived closer to Rashi's time. He lived in about the, I would say, 1150, about the same time as late Ibn Ezra, early Rambam. No, he did. Yeah, he did. We have Rashi on most of Ketuvim.
Yeah.
It's just considered Rashi is not, you know, where Rashi is like you can't learn Chumash without Rashi. You would say probably the same thing with you would probably say the same when it comes to medieval commentaries. You would say the same thing about Radak. I wouldn't want to learn Navi without Radak, and he's usually the go-to person. Not that it's not Rashi; it's very important to learn, but Radak is usually the go-to person. So let me read you Radak on Pasuk Zayin. V'im Evyatar Kohen. Actually, you know what? I'll read Rashi. It's right here in front of me, and he'll say the same thing. V'im Evyatar Kohen. Shenistalek mina kahuna mishibarach David Mishraim ibn Avshalom. So it's all circles. Evyatar was the Kohen Gadol, but he lost the job when David ran away from Jerusalem, running away from Avshalom during, that was in Shmuel Bet, that was in 2 Samuel. Sheshal b'urim v'tumim, because he, at the time, he asked from the Urim and Tumim, that was the breastplate with the jewels on it. V'lo al talo, God didn't want to talk to Evyatar. Shenemar v'yal Evyatar, and Evyatar got up. And that's all Rashi quotes. That is, it's a very strange pasuk. We're going to take a look at it shortly. Something's going on with Evyatar. David recognizes that God's not interested in Evyatar anymore, and therefore the kuna is removed from Evyatar and given to Tzadok HaKohen. So essentially you have two major players, Tzadok and Evyatar. And at that point, not even now, but at that point, back by David, theoretically, Evyatar is out of a job. He's fired from Kohen Gadol. Now Rashi goes on and tells something interesting. V'hayam ibnei banav shel Eli. He was a direct descendant of Eli. Eli is the Navi that starts off the whole, or the Navi in the Kohen that starts off the whole book of Samuel. Hannah comes around, she starts to pray quietly, Eli thinks he's drunk, she tells him essentially to go take a hike, and she says, oh, I'm very sorry. And then he's got these two rotten sons, Hophni and Pinchas, and God reads him the riot act, and he says, you know what? You're out of a job. You're out of a job. So let's see what that means. V'yeda shelo yishamesh b'mei Shlomo, shari nemar le'eli v'hakimoti li'kohen ne'amar v'italech l'fei mishichi, v'yach hafeit she'amod al zeh al yado. Let's take a look at the actual pasuk. If you have a Tanakh in front of you, so without losing the place, take a look at Sefer Shmuel Aleph, Perek Bet, Pasuk Lamed He. Shmuel, Samuel 1, chapter 2, verse 35. By the way, this is a famous story, of course. This is where Shmuel, the new prophet-to-be, is hanging around at night, and God says, Shmuel, Shmuel, and he wakes up, and he runs to Eli, and says, Eli, you called me? He said, I didn't call you, go back to sleep. Shmuel goes back to sleep, and God says, Shmuel, Shmuel, and he wakes up, and he runs, Eli, did you call me? Then Eli figures out that Shmuel is getting his first prophecy, and Eli makes him swear that he won't suppress any prophecy, because it's actually a death penalty law for a prophet to suppress prophecy. Most people think it's only a death penalty law for a prophet to lie about what he heard, but actually suppressing prophecy is also a death penalty law for a prophet, and then he comes and he reads Eli the Riot Act, and this is what he says.
What
Pasuk is that? Riot Act? Shmuel.
God, well, God, through Shmuel, reads Eli the Riot Act.
What Pasuk?
Pasuk, we might as well start from Pasuk Lamedaleth is probably better, chapter, verse 34. So God says, this is the proof that you're essentially, you're finished. You and your family are finished from being the elders, the Kohen Gadol. V'zelecha ha'ot, this is the sign that you know the prophecy will be true. Asher yavo al shnei banecha chofni u'finchas v'yom achad yamutu shnei. They're both going to die in one day. When that happens, you'll know I'm serious. Pasuk lamed hey. V'hakimoti li kohen ne'aman. And I will establish for myself a reliable kohen. Not you, obviously. not reliable, you. By the way, in this case, reliable, the word ne'aman doesn't really mean reliable, it means stable. Somebody that you could pass things down from generation to generation.
Mm-hmm.
The proof for that is when it says that Moshe's were, remember when Moshe's hands were up and when he lowered his hands, Amalek was winning. When he raised his hands, Israel was winning. So what it says there is Vayu Yadav Emunim. So normally when we think of the word emunah, we think means faithful, but it doesn't mean faithful, it means steady, consistent, solid, supported. In fact, in modern Hebrew, the word lehitamein means to exercise, and that's a pretty good translation, actually, to make oneself rock solid. It's a pretty good translation. He'll do what I want him to do. I'm going to build him a house which is stable, which means I will allow his sons to inherit. What this is talking about is kuna olam. Now, normally you wouldn't hear this language. Normally, when you hear something about I will build him a house that will be stable, a house, i.e., children that will inherit, you normally don't think of kuna. You think of a malchut. That's what it's all about. But here, the indication is that kuhuna is also hereditary. Mm-hmm. Kuhuna is also hereditary, and that's going to be a key factor when we talk about the Chashmonaim in about 5 minutes, because that's where it's all going to come into play, actually, very interestingly, hopefully. And he will walk before my Mashiach, my chosen king, my anointed one, all the days. So essentially we have two Mashiachs here. We have a Kohen Mashiach, and we have just a Mashiach. The assumption is a Melech Mashiach. Once there's a Melech Mashiach, then there will be a Kohen Mashiach. So what Rashi says is at this point, this is where Eli said that his kids would no longer be Kohen Gadols. But up to this point, Eli had a kid who had a kid who had a kid, and that kid was none other than Eviatar Kohen. But he wasn't ready to be removed yet, because it wasn't time to be removed. The time it was meant to remove is when God would appoint his king. But the king only got decided in whose days. Actually, it's not such a simple question. When did God actually decide on a king that was anointed? So it's one of two possibilities. It's not Saul. It's either David. Or Shlomo. He was anointed, but again, he didn't win. He didn't get the nod. And that's what I said last time, which I think is an important idea. You don't know if you're really the king until your son makes it. And therefore, we're going to find out that Eviatar, according to what we saw, Eviatar seems to get the bump during David's times. But we're going to see that he actually does not get the bump during David's time. It's Shlomo who bumps Eviatar from the position of Kohen Gadol. David wants to, but can't do it. And only Shlomo will bump Eviatar from
the
top.
That's only partially true, then, because once the kingdom was established, then it went on and on and on.
And what went on and on?
Irrespective of the kingdom, if you look at the kings of Judea or Israel, then the sons became king.
That's correct. Same with
Kuna. So that means it was established.
Yes.
So it had nothing to do with how well they behaved. And how well they
That's
were.
Correct. I agree. All you wanted to do was have that, you have to have one inheritance.
Okay.
And you've established kingship.
Once
I established one inheritance, and it was true, Shevet Yehudah never left. It was always father to son, always father to son. And what we'll see is Ezra proves that it's always Kohen to son, always Kohen to son, Kohen to son. And it's going to cause a big problem with the Maccabees because they break that. But Eviatar, so the big machoket is, why should Tzadok be a Kohen? Eli was the original Kohen. Eli was the son of Itamar, by the way. He was the Kohen Gadol. How can you take it away? What this is showing you in Shmuel is that inherited kahuna or kahuna olam only takes place when you have malchut olam. Up until that time, it's not hereditary. After that time, it's hereditary. And that's what God is trying to say.
Why is there a direct connection between whether kahuna gets passed down to whether kingship gets passed down? Shouldn't it be completely separate in itself?
You would think so. You would think that Kohen is a job. What do I need to pass it down? Why should I have to select the son? Why not select it? But by a Melech, of course I have to, because otherwise the families are all at each other's throats. But when it comes to a Kohen, why not just select the most spiritual Kohen? In fact, that's the way they did it during the Second Temple period. Well, no, during the Second Temple period, they gave it to whoever paid the highest price to the Syrian governors at the time. That's how they did it. But theoretically, they could have chosen the people who deserve it the most, and that's what Chashmonaim did. You know which Chashmonai, I'm sort of jumping ahead a little bit, but I guess since we already raised the issue, there was a Chashmonai who was a big, if you take a look in the Book of Maccabees, it was a really rough day. They knew they were in trouble. There was one Chashmonai, there were a series of Chashmonaim, they were all acted as a Kohen Gadol, but it wasn't until one guy that they said, I'm the Kohen Gadol, and that's good forever. Do you know who that, anybody know who it was? It was Shimon Atzadik. Before him was Yonatan. He acted as a Kohen Gadol, but he never claimed to be a Kohen Gadol. And before him was Yehuda Maccabee, who also acted as a Kohen Gadol, but never claimed to be a Kohen Olam. It was a temporary job until they could get their acts back together. The actual Kohen was a guy by the name of Chonia, or Onias, who mostly they got murdered off.
Matityahu was a Kohen Gadol.
What's that?
Matityahu
was not a Kohen Gadol. Matityahu was a Kohen, not a Kohen Gadol. Onias was the Kohen Gadol. He was a direct descendant of the Tzadokite family. He got murdered by his brother. His brother wanted to be the king. His name was, I can't remember. He was in collusion with Antiochus Epiphanes, or Antiochus's father. They murdered off Onias. Another brother ran away to Egypt, where he set up a Ben HaMikdash, by the way. Set up a Ben HaMikdash. And he served there during the Hasmonaim period. They just got rid of him. What's that? No, not in a place called Niv, which is all the way down on the... Because they couldn't be as close as Alexandria. They put it all the way down south so as not to be in conflict with the Ben HaMikdash. But they built the Ben HaMikdash, and Onias worked there. There was a real issue on who was supposed to be the Kohen. And you should read the Qumran people about when Shimon takes the job as Kohen Gadol Olam. Boy, you should hear what they write about him. They never call him by name. Speaker of evil, the doomed one, the son of the devil. Yeah, you think we're nasty to each other. You should see what the Qumran people write about it. We'll see how the Qumran people thought of themselves. But it was a big deal. And he tries to justify it. He says, listen, Shimon says there's not a Navi around. There never will be a Navi around. So until there's a Navi around who says who should be the Kohen Gadol, I'm the Kohen Gadol forever. And my children forever after. And let me tell you something. People were most annoyed.
Is the concept of a Kohen Gadol, is that a Torah?
That's the Torah, absolutely, and built into the Torah is Kohen Gadol. And Sefer Shemot, the Kohen Gadol wears the special things. He's the only one who's allowed to go into Kodesh Kodeshim once a year.
Does the Torah say who is supposed to take the Kohen Gadol? Because it sounds like it's sort of precedent and whoever is most powerful.
It seems to be the word of... Well, that's how it turned out. It was supposed to be the... That's what the Tzaddik family is telling you. That's why the Shmuel is writing the Sefer. You would have thought that it was Itamar's children. Itamar got pushed out. Eli got pushed out because of his sins. Now I'm going to select a different guy. I'm going to select Tzadok. It turns out Tzadok, by the way, was the great-great-great-great-grandson of Pinchas. Pinchas ben Elazar, a Kohen. So essentially, the Kahuna switched from the younger son, the younger Kohen, to the elder Kohen, but not the elder son of the elder Kohen. Pinchas, who was quite a handy guy with a spear. Not everybody was pro Pinchas whatsoever. So when Tzadok gets the nod, I assure you there were people whispering... There were people hiding their spears, you know. There was a lot of talk. Things are never so simple. You trust the Navi. The Navi tells you it's going to be Tzadok. But let's take a look and see what actually happens. Where does Eviatar lose the job? So now, the next mention of Eviatar is something very strange. You start to sense that David HaMelech doesn't know exactly what to do about the whole Tzadok Eviatar thing. So if you open up to Samuel 2, to Shmuel Bet, Perek Zion, chapter 8, the last four verses, very powerful verses. Chapter 8, verse 15. Vayimloch David al kol Yisrael. David managed to grab power. He managed to rule over all of Israel, north and south. He did justice and righteousness to all his people. That's a pasuk in itself, but we won't go into it. The Yoav ben Tzruiah Tzava, Yoav was in charge of the army. The Hoshafat ben Achilud Maskir, he was a Maskir, whatever that means. The Tzadok ben Achituv, the Achimelech ben Eviatar Kohanim. So the two chief Kohanim are Tzadok and the son of Eviatar. Strange, right? Eviatar is still in the picture. We see Eviatar is alive and well. But he's not mentioned as the Kohen. The Kohen job has now been split into two. Tzadok gets it, and the son of Eviatar. One gets the feeling that David's not sure he's in the position to play this game. You know what I mean? It's not so easy to remove a Kohen from his position. A Kohen has a significant power base. There's no doubt about it. He's in charge of the temples. Not so easy for a king to go against his high priest. And you should know something. There were entire dynasties of Egypt that fell because the pharaohs decided to go against the priests. And the priest said, guess what? You're going before we go. Not so simple. So I think David is struggling with this whole thing. So what he does is he appoints the son of Eviatar over Eviatar. What's that?
Oh, I thought, killed Ahimelech.
The Kohanim in Nov.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. That would be the father of Eviatar, if I'm not mistaken, or the grandfather of Eviatar. That was the Eviatar line.
Mm-hmm.
That's the Eli line. That's the Itamar line. But it's not the Tzadok line. His children took over after him,
mm-hmm.
as you could see from here. Now, then let me just tell you a little bit of what's going on, because I see I'm spending a little bit too much time on this, and I want to get back to the story. David is on the run from Absalom. It all comes back to he's on the run from Absalom. So the question is, what happens? Tzadok brings brings the Aron Kodesh with David. And David doesn't want it. He says, listen, you've got to return the Aron Kodesh. If God brings you back to Yerushalayim, that's fine. But there's no way I'm going to. It's a big move on David, probably David's greatest moment. They bring him the Holy of Holies. He says, send it back. It's a tremendous move on David's part. Well, let's see who brings it to him.
Why is it a tremendous move?
Because it's humble. He's, you know, normally if you run away, you want to get the power, you take all the power with you, which means the Aron. But he's saying, no, my son is in charge. My son won, essentially. His son is now king of... My son is now king in Yerushalayim, and I'm not going to take the Aron out of Yerushalayim. That's not my right to do such a thing. That's a tremendous righteous thing on David. A normal person, I think, a person less great than David would have said, I'll take it with me, because that'll show that I've got the power, and I've got the power base, and God's on my side. He said, no, the Kohen, the whole idea of Kuna and priesthood, that lives without me. I'm a king. I'm not going to steal away. I'm not going to take something away from where it's supposed to be. I think it's a tremendously humble move on David's part, and I suspect it's the reason why David finally gets the nod. For whatever sin David commits, this he doesn't commit the ultimate sin of trying to pretend that he's that he has the right to decide where God should live. So in Perek, in chapter 15 is the rebellion. Shmuel Bet, chapter 15, Perek Tetvav, Pasuk. Pasuk Chaf Gimel 23. V'chol haaretz bochim, the whole countryside is crying. Kol gadol, v'chol ha'am ovrim, and all the whole nation, all the refugees that are running away from the onslaught, the rebellion of Absalom, his son. V'amelech over b'nachal Kidron, passes Nachal Kidron. V'chol ha'am ovrim al pnei derech ha'midbar. They're all running away to cross the Jordan River. By the way, on your maps, I have a few of these to get an idea of what's going on. Let me pass them around. So you see where Kidron Valley is?
Mm-hmm.
To the east of Jerusalem, you'll see Kidron Valley. That's Nachal Kidron. So essentially, he runs down out of the city of David. He gathers as many people as he can, because Absalom is coming from the north from Hebron, and he runs down to get to.
Wait a minute, Hebron is in the south.
In the south, that's right. So Absalom is moving up with his troops, about to take Jerusalem. David knows he's hosed, so he runs down to the Kidron Valley. He crosses the Kidron Valley, which, by the way, if you get across, is a pretty good defense, because it's hard to get a lot of troops up and down there. And he starts to run away. By the way, these two places, which you may see, the Gihon and Ein Rogel, are going to be very significant in what's going on today in Malachim. But you should just know, so David's running away, and it, essentially over here to the east is the Jordan River, not too far away. I mean, a decent little walk, but not too far away. So that's where David runs away. So back to verse 24. V'nei gam Tzadok v'chol ha-levim ito. Who shows up? Tzadok and all the Levim. Nosim et aron brit Elohim. And they're carrying the Holy Ark. Vayatziku et aron Elohim, and they put it. Vayatziku means they stick it in the ground. They settle it down. It's very strange. Why aren't they settling it down? Why aren't they running with it? Vayal Eviatar, and then Eviatar comes up. Aton kol ha'am la'avor min ha'ir, until the rest of the city manages to. The rest of the people run away from the city. Very difficult pasuk. Rashi says, take out the words Vayal Eviatar. The way it should read is like this: Vayatziku et aron Elohim ad Tom kolam lavoratair. What it means is they stuck the ark in. They wouldn't let it move until everybody got out of Jerusalem, and then they started running away. And then Eviatar vayal Eviatar, which Rashi, if you remember, means that Eviatar tried to raise God, so to speak, and God wouldn't talk to him. But what it's really trying to tell you, in my opinion, is the reason why they had to stick the Aron is because there was only one person who could speak to the Aron. Why do they have to wait for Eviatar? The way, in my opinion, the way it's read is like this. But I speak with their own Elohim. They had the Aron Elohim, but they couldn't do anything with it. David wanted to know what was going on. Am I going to live or am I going to die? But he couldn't move, because guess who didn't show up yet? Eviatar. And if Abiathar, the only person allowed to really manage the ark, Levim could move it, but they couldn't manage it. The only person that could manage the ark was Abiathar, because Abiathar was the Kohen Gadol. But when does Abiathar show up? Shows up last. You see? Tzadok and Levim come running. Where's Abiathar? Abiathar's hanging out. Vayal Abiathar ad tom kolam lavor minayir. He was like the last guy out. He was the guy who closed the lights. You know, the last guy out closed the lights? That was Abiathar. So you get the sense that Abiathar is not quite sure whose side he's on. Like, the city's being attacked. David's running away. He's got Tzadok is with him. He's got the other Levim with him. And they had, they're stuck. We can't move. Why? We can't wait for Cohen Gadol. Oh, I think he's packing his bags. He'll be here in 5 minutes. You get a sense that Abiathar is not quite there. And what reinforces this? Look at the next pasuk in pasuk 25. Vayomer HaMelech leTzadok hashev et Aron Elohim ha'ir. He doesn't tell Abiathar to bring the Aron back. He tells Tzadok to bring the Aron back. You get the feeling that Abiathar, that David recognizes, that not only, see, you could say that it's all part of the prophecy, and maybe that's true. But what you should also get the feeling is that Abiathar is not quite sure whose side he's on, and David doesn't know how to treat him. And we got that sense when he appointed Abiathar's son rather than him in a position of kuhuna. He just doesn't trust this Abiathar guy, and justifiably, David is a smart politician. Abiathar is the last guy out, and David is already starting to ignore him. There's one other part which we need to see in Shmuel, because it's going to come key to our whole story here. So if you can, go to chapter 17, and I'll set the stage. Shmuel Bet. Yeah. I know I'm supposed to be teaching Sefer Melach, I'm teaching Shmuel Bet, but sometimes it's important. You have to learn a whole bunch of other things to understand one pasuk in Melach HaMalach.
Shmuel Bet, what
pasuk? Verse 17. I'll set the stage. David tells Tzadok and Abiathar to go back and act as spies. I don't want you with me. Take the Aron back, both of you, in the end. You tell me what's going on. Of course, I'm not sure he trusts Abiathar, but he trusts Abiathar's son. So what does he say? When you hear whether they're coming for me or not coming for me, there's a whole question of whether they're going to attack me in the same night or not. When you find out what the word is, you send your two sons. Tzadok had a son, and Abiathar had a son. And you tell them to tell me to run after me up Nachal Kidron, and they'll tell me exactly whether I should run or whether I have time to gather food and forces. Let's see where this takes place. The Yehonatan v'Achimatz, these are the two children of Tzadok and Abiathar, Omdim be'Ein Rogel. Where are they hanging out? Ein Rogel. Now find Ein Rogel on the map, if you would.
Ein Rogel was where Adoniyahu
had his party. Exactly right. It all, history repeats itself. It's all going to come together. They're down in Ein Rogel. Now Ein Rogel is to the south. If you see the city of David, you got to go down about half a kilometer to three quarters of a kilometer down to Ein Rogel. What?
Just above the E.
That's right. E8, actually. Yeah, that's good. E8. So that's Ein Rogel. What's significant of Ein Rogel? It's an Ein, by the way, doesn't mean eye. It means a fountain. It means, what do you call it when water spurts out of the ground? Spring. An Ein is a spring. Probably it's connected with the idea of an eye, and it comes like the watering eye or something. But the translator's eye is a mistake. It's really, when it says that Rivka went down to the Ein, it doesn't mean she went down to the Ein. It means she went down to the spring. That's the correct translation. Apparently this Shifcha was hired by Tzadok and by Abiathar. According to Rashi, it was actually Tzadok's Shifcha, it was her handmaiden, to go tell them that essentially Achitophel is not coming to get you right away, that it was delayed. They'll make a run up Ein Rogel in Kidron Valley. You gotta figure that David is already up by 4E, maybe even 3E. You see what I'm saying? That's probably where David is, and maybe even further off. Maybe not E, maybe FG. He's probably crossed over Ein Rogel. So what they do is they're going to run down the valley and then probably cross over around where F4 or F is and find David. That's the plan. And they'll have some cover. But of course, they're running right past the city of David. Anybody who happens to be looking out the window is going to see them, which is exactly what happens. Kilo yuchlu lehiraot lavo ha'ira. Why do they have to wait by Ein Rogel? Because they can't afford to be seen in the city. Lo yichlu le'ra'ot be'ir. What does it tell you about Ein Rogel as far as its visual connection with the city of David? It's out of sight. Why do they have to be in Ein Rogel? Because if they were north of that by the Gihon or something else, they would have been seen. They would have known that they were sitting there spying waiting for, by the way, in Rogel might be Meragel, the word spy, although most of the Farshim don't go there, but it's not impossible. They can't hang out closer. They go to in Rogel where they won't be seen. They'll get the word, and then they'll run to David as fast as they can and hopefully avoid the spying eyes. It doesn't work. They get seen. The whole thing happens, but in the end, everything works out okay. What this tells us is a few interesting things. Ein Rogel is a significant position, and it is not visible from the city. Why is that important? Now let's go back. Now we're ready for Sefer Melachim. Let's go back to Sefer Melachim. The party of Adoniyahu is in Ein Rogel. Where is that written? Hold on a second. Pasuk Tet. Vayizbach Adoniyahu, this is chapter 1, Pasuk Tet. Vayizbach Adoniyahu, Tzon of Akal Marim, Eben HaZochel, Asher Eitz Lein Rogel, Vayikrad Kol Echad Bnei HaMelech, he calls the brothers, Kol Anshe Yudav Avdei HaMelech. So his part is Ein Rogel, we know exactly where it is. And it's probably significant that there are many things that took place there at the time. Now, when the king finds out, the king, if you remember last week, we found out the king woke up from his slumber, and he says, you're right, Batsheva, Shlomo is the guy I want to appoint, so I'm telling you to go appoint him to be the king right now. Let's go to that pasuk and see that happen.
Where is that?
That is in verse...
Which chapter are we?
We're chapter 1, verse 32.
Chapter 1?
Chapter 1, verse 32.
Oh,
in Melachim. I'm sorry. We're in Melachim. I'm going to read through it quickly. Vayomer Melech David, the King David. By the way, this is significant. Melech David... I think it has certain significance. Kiru li tzadik hakohen. You get me tzadik hakohen. V'lenatana navi, and I want the prophet, v'anayu ben yoyada, I want the military guy, v'yavoz ne melech. I want them all here. Keep in mind that Natan was already in the room, right? So the question is, what's going on? Obviously, what's going on is a show. David's putting on a political show. V'yomer amelech lahem, kui machem et avdei adonichem. First of all, take the avadim of your servants. Now, if you remember, last time, the avadim actually sided. The Avadim you could think of as the bureaucracy. The bureaucracy sided with, what's that? The State Department. They had sided with Adoniyahu. David's no idiot. David knows that I don't care whether you like them or not, you can't live without a bureaucracy, that you're going to go down if you have no bureaucracy. You need to get some of them and pull them with you. You must force them to comply. I don't want to get that into that too much, but I think it should be obvious to most people. I think it's a little bit like Bush going and making ice to the Europeans. As much as I'm sure Bush would like to throw French fries at them, the bottom line is you don't get anywhere in politics by doing that. I mean, it's arguable, but I think that's what David is saying here. V'yakavtem et Shlomo b'ni al ha-pirda. You ride him al ha-pirda. Now, ha-pirda means the pirda, which means not just any pirda, which is a mule, but the mule. So you already know that he's riding on the mule of the king. That's why it says ha-pirda, capital, what? Oh, that's even better. Asher Elibo, ra'atam el Gichon. Now, he tells him where to go. David is brilliant. Now, take a look at your map, and look where the party for Shlomo is. The ceremony party for Shlomo is in the Gichon. Now, the Gihon is not really positioned well on this map because it's not all the way down in the valley. The Gihon is a spring which is halfway up the valley towards the city of David.
Not
it comes direct...
Away.
What?
Not very far away.
It's right next to the... And it not, what it does is it sets up... It's like a halfback getting in the way. You see what I'm saying? Adoniyahu is cut off now from the city. And when people look out at the city, when your hoi polloi look out at the city... They don't see Ein Rogel, which may be the nicest place to have a party, but it's not the best place to have a party because it's far away. And we learned in Sefer Shmuel that it was so far away that you couldn't make eye contact from one to the other, probably too deep in the valley. I don't know if you're familiar with that, by the way. If you go around, it's called Gei Ben Hinnom, and you have that big valley, and there's the place where they have concerts, and you really go down quite a bit there. It's not visible. Ein Rogel is not directly visible. It's close to Silwan. Silwan is in our village now. It's sort of on the other side. As you go to Chizkiyahu's tunnel. What?
It's across the Kidron on the slope going up.
Is it all right? I think Ein Rogel is in the valley before. It's
right, but Silwan is across the valley on the slope going up.
On the east side. Yeah. Right, I think it's immediately to the east. But at least
the
court...
Kidron is also a significant place.
Why? This is the first
because
time we've heard of it.
Source.
So is Ein Rogel. They're both water sources of... The word Eben HaZochelet, the rock that drips, gives the impression that there's a water place going on there as well. I think Gihon is more connected with the city. It's the water which directly feeds the city. Absolutely right, which is why Chizkiyahu protected it with a second wall. He built a wall around it so they couldn't poison the waters. But strategically going on here, it's a beautiful move, because not only could the city people not see the party of Adoniyahu, they can see the party of They can see the party of Shlomo HaMelech, but what's more to the point is they've just cut them off from the city. Normally after the party you have the ceremony, you all march up, they're going nowhere. They got a party right in their face. They got to cut now through Shlomo's party. It's a brilliant move geographically, and it's a brilliant move politically, and that's really what's going on. Let's continue. Umashach otosham, you anoint him there. Tzadok Kohen and Atan Navi Lemelech, verse 34, Yisrael. Utkatem b'shofar, and blow the horns of Martin Yechi HaMelech Shlomo. This is what David is trying to do. Long live the king. Valita macharav uvav ayashav ad kisi. You make the procession. You come back here. You're not just hanging out there for a party. You need to come back to my seat. This is now impossible for Adoniyahu's party because they're cut off. You can see graphically, there's no way up. You have to pass through the Gihon up into the city of David, I think. Otherwise, you have to go all the way around. Not even sure how to do it the other way. V'hu yimloch tachtai v'oto tziviti liyot nagira Yisrael v'ayuda. Pasuk 36. V'yam b'nayav yodah melech v'yomer amen. Yes. Kein yomar Adonai Elohei Adonai HaMelech. That's exactly what God wanted to do. Asher haya Adonai im Adonai HaMelech kein yeh im Shlomo. God will be with him like he was you. V'yidel kisomi kisei Adonai HaMelech David. He'll be even greater than you are. Nothing. Everybody loves their son to be greater than they are, so obviously Dov is not insulted. This is the secret police. They do what he told them to do. They take the holy oil, they pour it over his head. Now, because keep in mind that by putting in the Gihon, it's not just the people at the Gihon. The whole city is involved in a way that was not true. Let's put it this way, perhaps. Maybe I'm stretching it. Adoniyahu threw a party like a Hollywood party. Only those could get in, and there were bouncers at the door. You know, if you were somebody, you could get in. Not so, according to this. Vayichi, vayomru kol ha'am, yichi ha'melech Shlomo. Kol ha'am means the nation, not just the big guys. Doesn't mean everybody, doesn't mean every little woman and child. But the word kol ha'am indicates, I'm sorry, I apologize. It just didn't work that way back then, I apologize. I mean, I apologize, it's just the way it is. It was. You still had to have people of some significance, but the word am indicates a mass. And why not? Because they were right there. They probably looked down. There was a big party. Oh, so it's a party. Let's go. And the doors were open. It was one of those everybody welcome parties. It's brilliant. I mean, David knows what he's doing. No doubt about it. Vayalu kol am acharav, and the whole nation leads him on a walks after him in procession. Va'am mechalim, mechalim. They're playing flutes. Smechim simcha gdolah. Vatibakaris b'kol am. The earth shakes with their noise. Vayishma Adoniyahu kol akurim asher ito. And Adoniyahu hears the kol hakruim asherito. That's important. Kol hakruim are all those who are called. That emphasizes the point I was trying to make. It was a party for those who had tickets. You see what I'm saying? It wasn't a party for the hoi polloi. The heim kilu lechol. They'd finished eating. Vayishma Yoav kol ha-shofar. Now Yoav's not an idiot. He hears the shofar. Vayom vadua kol ha-kiryahoma. Why is the city going up like this? Odenu medaber vehine Yonatan ben Aviatar kohen ba vayomer Adoniyahu bo. So Yonatan ben Aviatar comes, he says, listen, vayomer Adoniyahu bo ki ish chayo ata v'tov t'vaser. Adoniyahu says to the kohen, this is Aviatar's son, who we've met before, and I'll reemphasize that in a second. He says to Aviatar's son, oh, I know you're ben chayo. Now ben chayo doesn't mean a soldier, it means loyal. That's the way to translate it in most cases in Tanakh. You're loyal to me, and you're going to give me good news. Vayan Yonatan vayomer laAdoniyahu, he says Adoniyahu, aval, but, and by the way, in Aramaic it's never but. How do you know it's not but? Because it starts a sentence. You can't start a sentence with but. If I give the translation for aval is kushta. Kushta means indeed, in fact. That's what aval originally meant until Sefer Daniel, and later Sfarim when it was changed to but, and in modern Hebrew it's but that's not what it means. In biblical Hebrew, ach is but. Aval means indeed, and that's the translation. You can look at Unkelus and Targum Yonatan. It's always the same. Aval indeed, Adoniyahu Amelch David Himlichet Shlomo. Vayishlach Oto Melch Tzadok Kohen. He gave him Tzadok. Then Atan Navi, and he gave him the whole party and the whole thing. Vayimshcho Oto Pasuk 45, and he anointed him king. Tzadok Kohen and Atan Navi Lemelch BeGichon. Vayalu Misham Shmechim Tehem Kiryak Kol Asher Shmatem. You hear the noise. Everybody is happy about this.
So wait a minute, is this Yonatan?
Yonatan, the son of Eviatar. Eviatar is there at the party.
Yonatan, the son of
Eviatar. No, same guy. Yeah, Yonatan is Yonatan, same guy.
So this time he's changed
son. It's a good question. Yonatan, Adoniyahu is happy to see Yonatan because Yonatan is the son of his Adoniyahu. Sorry, son of his Eviatar, the Kohen. But he's forgotten something. Yonatan has already been appointed. The sons of Abiathar have always already been appointed by David and trusted by David. Not only that, they were trusted with the job to save David's life. And they did it.
So Abiathar is basically a lame duck.
Abiathar is a lame duck as soon as his son shows up. Mm-hmm. And not only that, the question is, well, I want to read a little further ahead because the game is over. I want you to show you, Yoav, who's the smart guy, knows that the game is over. Let's read what Yoav says. V'gam yashav Shlomo akisei ma'amucha. Shlomo has taken the throne. That's verse 46. Verse 47. Mem Zayin. V'gam ba'av be'amelech. Guess what? You also lost. Not only did you lose the people, not only did you lose the king, you also lost the Avadim. You know where they are. You look at the seats. See those empty seats? I'll tell you who used to be there. The Avadim that were with you, they just, the bureaucracy just switched sides. L'varech et Adonenu ha'melech David le'mor yetiv Elohim et shem Shlomo mishmecha v'yagdel kitzo mikitzecha v'yishtachu ha'melech ha'meshkav. I'm going to skip what that means in a second. Memchet. Let me just finish this part so v'gam kach amar ha'melech, and out of that the king said, Baruch Adonai Elohei Yisrael shenatan ha'yom yosheva kisiv v'enei ra'ot. I'm glad that I saw my son rule while I was still alive. And I'm going to get back to that in a second. That's important. Everybody who was called to the party of Elnial, they all bugged out. They knew the game was over. Pasuk Nun, Vadoniahu Yarei Mipnei Shlomo, Vayakam Vayelech Lekozei Pekonu Mizbeach. Adoniahu is afraid that Shlomo's going to kill me. He goes to run to the Mizbeach and he grabs onto the Mizbeach. Why does Yoav know that the game is over? For a number of reasons. First of all, he's lost the Avadim. Second of all, they know they're cut off geographically. Yoav is a military man. They got the Gichon. End of story. But the worst part is, they put their faith in Yonatan. But look what Yonatan, look how Yonatan refers to David. How does he refer to David in Pasuk 44? And the gam yashav Shlomo kisei amucha, the gam bo avdei amelech levarech et Adoneinu. What is Adoneinu? They're referring to David. What does Adoneinu mean? Our boss. You follow what he's saying? Yonatan is not being dumb here. He's not some little kid. He was a Kohen. Maybe even sometimes not a Kohen Gadol, but certainly high up in the Kuna. When he says to Adoniahu, Adonenu has put on Melech Shlomo, ball game's over.
What? There's nothing more to talk about. He's half dead, he's sick, and then all of a sudden he puts his foot down.
What's that? Yes, but what's interesting is the Kuna, you would have thought, I still have Yoav. Yoav's the military. But I only have the military, because first of all, Benayahu is there with the Plati and the Plati, so we got a good military conflict. Plus, Yoav knows the game's over, because he can't get to Yerushalayim. He knows he's cut off. At least I don't have a prophet. I never had a prophet, so I don't got that game. At least I have the Kohen Gadol. But who shows up to tell me that I don't actually have the Kohen Gadol anymore? Kohen Gadol's son! Kohen Gadol shows up and says, excuse me, Dad, would you excuse me a second? You're in big trouble. And when that happens, when your son tells you that you're out of a job, there's nothing more to talk about. So he's lost military, he's lost the Avadim, he's lost the bureaucracy, he has his own kahuna saying that the king has established his son. Adoniahu has nothing left. Adoniahu knows he's dead, and Yoav knows he's in big trouble too. We'll get to Yoav next time. But you can see the whole thing is played out so beautifully, and David knows exactly who to get and exactly who to place people. And by the way, he probably sent Yonatan. I wouldn't be surprised if he said, Yonatan, would you do me a favor? Would you go run and bring this message? Because that's the knife in the back, you know, or the knife in the guts. Brilliant. Brilliant political players, David Amelech. There's no doubt about it.
Isn't he kind of old at this point?
Well, but that's the whole thing. Now I want to talk about it. We have 10 more minutes, so I want to talk about that. And I'm sorry, I was reading so fast. I apologize. I was reading and slurring my words. So I implore you again, if I read too fast about the whole fact that everything falls down, so please, if you get a chance, read the section. If you look at it, you'll see how Yonatan is really, you know, murdering his father in a sense, and murdering Adoniah's chances and the whole thing. So I apologize for reading quickly. Sefer Devar Hayamim presents a whole different picture. One imagines from reading Sefer Melachim that the king is about to die. He manages to prop up his eyes for a second and say, Shlomo, you've got a job. And as soon as Shlomo gets the crown, David croaks. I don't want to take the time to read it now. If you get a chance, it's the last few chapters of Chronicles 1, which is Devar Hayamim. David is alive for years. Mm-hmm. Years.
And
he helped
Shlomo
after Shlomo was alive. And that's, let me get to this pasuk. Let me reread the pasuk, which I slurred over, and now I want to emphasize. Pasuk, verse 48, Memchad. V'gam kach amar melech. This is what the king said. Baruch Adonai Elohei Yisrael, God is blessed, or blessed God, Asher Natan Hayom Yoshev Al Kisi Ve'enai Ro'ot. The best thing that could have happened to me today is not only did my son get the job, but it got the job in my lifetime. And now I'll tell you something very interesting about the ancient Near East. Ancient Near East co-regencies were incredibly rare. Co-regencies. Generally speaking, a father did not appoint which son would get it. It was generally known to be the oldest son, but the father would stay out of it for a very simple reason. In Egypt, by the way, there was maybe two or three kings that ever set up co-regency, and they were reasonably successful. In Egypt, it should be obvious why, because the king is not just a king. A king is
God.
Can't have two. Can't have two gods. Can't have two supreme gods, the people representing, whether it's Amun or whether it's Re or Amun Re, whatever it is. I cannot have two kings at the same time. It goes against the whole ethos. Which is why when there was, I believe the king was Meremtah, I could be wrong, I get the names wrong, it was earlier, it was sometime earlier in like the 8th or 9th dynasty, and it wasn't repeated, not by Ramses, not by a lot of people. You would think that they would be smart enough to appoint their sons. They did not do such a thing. They just didn't, because they couldn't. It was not, for us it seems so obvious. You want to avoid all the strife? Pick a guy, put a crown on his head, and now you have two rulers. Well, first of all, that's a little bit weird, because then you have a lame duck situation. Even for a president, that's a little bit weird. Happens in Hasidus, right? So the cool question is, why didn't the Rebbe select who would be the next person? So you could say by the time it got around to it, it was already old, and maybe the Rebbe hoped that he would be the Mashiach, and then he wouldn't die. I don't know. I'm not coming here to be sarcastic about it. I don't know what was going on in the Rebbe's head. I believe he was a great Talmud Chacham. He was a friend of my Rebbe, and he was one of the great Talmud Chachamim of the 20th century. But why doesn't a man select a ruler? Why doesn't a man select the next person down? It would avoid so much problems. And yet it was a rare occurrence in the Middle East. And even in Mesopotamia, where only maybe 1 out of 10 kings thought he was a god, although even though the king didn't feel he was a god, the king would go to the special holy prostitutes who would represent the goddesses, and they would sleep with them, and the children would be born of a god, so to speak. So even in Mesopotamia, where the kings didn't often consider themselves to be gods, they were as close as you could get without getting burnt. And the simple fact was that the co-regencies, two kings, were very rare. David has invented something brilliant here that has not been done, and he got it right. I realize that God is blessed because I just realized what I'm supposed to do. I'm not supposed to die and then say, whoever wants to fight for it wins. My job is to select the ruler in my lifetime, and my job is to appoint that ruler in my lifetime. And David is a lame duck. He is. The assumption is, what's that? That's exactly the point. But the question is, who's really calling the shots? And we don't know, really. From Chronicles, from Divrei Yamim, it's a little hard to tell. My guess is that Shlomo's calling the shots. Although maybe not. Maybe until Shlomo's old enough. It's hard to say.
It's
a good question. Not as young as people think, but we can't solve the problem in one. I don't want to give it away, because it's not so simple. And we'll have to analyze some psukim, because there are two ways to read it. Either he was very young or not so young. I don't think he was as young as most people think.
But you stated that David was being alive for many, many years.
Many years. I would say
at least two or three.
Well, I mean, that's a long time to be a co-ruler. I guess many years, I guess you picture it. I don't think he lived, he was 70 years old when he gave the nod to Shlomo. 72, 73, 74, he was around long enough to help him build the Beit HaMikdash. And by the way, not to build it, but he laid out all the blueprints, he collected all the money, he designed the Beit HaMikdash. He sat around with his blueprints and literally made a Beit HaMikdash. He then gave the blueprints to his son and said, do this, which makes sense, by the way, because Shlomo, whether Shlomo's a prophet or not, is very doubtful. But there's very little doubt that David was a prophet.
But wait a second. Isn't the reason why Adonijahu proclaims kingship was because he thought David the Melech was on his way out?
That's correct, and he felt that he was the next person.
So he must have been a very old man.
He was 70 years old. So, but his sickness was not because of age. His sickness was because of despair. The sickness was because he felt that he had no right to say who should get the king. And he felt that Shlomo may be part of a child of sin. He was not willing to back Shlomo. So he just said, what many people do is, I can't make up my mind. I'm not sure I have the right to do it. I just won't say anything. What?
Like Abraham.
I guess, in a sense. Or like people today.
He was very deeply depressed.
He was tremendously depressed. Mm-hmm. And the reason why, and probably one of the things that caused depression is, I got two brothers that are willing to kill each other. I don't know who's right. I don't know whether Adonijah, the oldest one, should get it right, or Shlomo, the one that Natan tells me is the right guy. I don't know. Maybe what I do with Bathsheba is a terrible sin, like they're trying to remind me with the Pelegis, with this pretty girl from Shunem. I just don't know. I'm depressed. I've had a miserable, difficult, war-ridden life, and I'm too tired to make the decision. And that's the beauty that you see here. David wakes up and says, I'll make a decision, and it's like in Tehillim, where it looks like you're sad, and all of a sudden you wake up and things are fine. Because sometimes what makes you fine is the recognition that you should be fine, you know? If it's psychosomatic, and I don't mean to underestimate psychosomatic, but if the problem is psychological, the cure is to reverse the psychological state, which David does. Again, the proof is not here. We see David die. He gives him the last will and testament. He dies. The proof is in Divrei HaYamim. Shlomo's got a lot. He anoints all the Levim, blueprints. He couldn't have done that in a month. I don't know if it took him 10 years. It certainly took him less than 4 or 5 years, I guess, because the temple was already built in, I believe, started to be built in Shlomo's 4th or 5th year. But I would best guess, 2, maybe 3 years on the throne as a co-regent, which is nice.
And you think Shlomo was alive when the temple was built?
I think David was dead when the stone started going in. But he was alive when. But he was not only was alive, but Divrei HaYamim testifies the fact that the blueprints were laid. He designed it himself. It wasn't Shlomo.
Okay.
David designed the Beit HaMikdash. David hired the Levim. He put them into the Mishmarot. He put them into the order. He got the money. He made the deals. He was the brains behind the application. He was the architect.
Yeah, but Shlomo didn't use a lot of the stuff that David put aside. He used his own stuff.
That's how it appears, because in Sefer Malachim, David's out of the picture. That's not the way it looks, and there's a lot of crossover here. It does look like Shlomo's sending up people to do the actual corvée work. To do the actual digging of rock, and acquiring and whatnot, but it looks like that. It looks like David HaMelech collected all the cash for such a hiring. Looks like he collected the cash for that kind of hiring.
I think it said that David HaMelech also collected the material, but that Shlomo used his own stuff.
My guess is he collected wood. Stone was up to Shlomo. Stone was the hard thing to.
I think it was the gold.
Oh yeah, you're probably right. We should take some time to read Chronicles, but we're already out of time. The idea of kuna, by the way, I guess I touched just to wrap up. The idea of kuna, I just wanted to mention that kuna is kunat olam. And the Dead Sea Scrolls sect, they call themselves none other than B'nai Tzadok. And of course, the people who didn't like the Pharisees were called the Tzidukim, the Tzadokites. Everybody wanted to call themselves the B'nai Tzadok. It's like calling John's original pizza. What's the name of that pizza store? And there are like 80 of them in New York City.
Ray's
original pizza. And people like sue each other over, because when you're Ray's original pizza, you know that you're the original pizza. So Lahavdil, the same thing is going on with Tzadok. Tzadok is a kuna olam. It is passed down. And in fact, according to the Tzadokites, when David HaMelech's family was lost, they became the Mashiachs and not David. It looks like they still have the idea of two Mashiachs, the Mashiach of Kohen, the Mashiach of David, but the Mashiach of Kohen becomes the priority. That's how the Dead Sea Scrolls sect felt it. Obviously, the Chashmonim sort of felt that way also, because they did not give the nod back to the House of David. They felt that there was no House of David. They felt that the Kohanim, were the new House of David, which was rejected by the Pharisees, even though the Pharisees supported the Chashmonai. So that's the idea of the Kohen. Eviatar gets the boot, but as much not only because he's cursed from Eli, but because a family is what a family breeds, and Eviatar was a very disloyal guy. The nice thing about Eviatar is his son was loyal. David, another point that I guess I want to make is David knew how to pick him and choose him. And David knew how to really establish, he knew how to play the political game. Nobody could outsmart David. So next time, what we didn't get to today, it's clear why Shlomo wins. What we didn't get to today is why Eviatar thinks that he's going to be safe. Sorry. Why Adoniyahu thinks he's going to be safe by running away to a Mizbeach. How does a Mizbeach save his life? And then in chapter 2, when Adoniyahu gets killed for trying to marry the Pelegesh, why does he get killed for trying to marry the Pelegesh? I apologize, I did not answer your question today. It'll have to be next time. Why does he want to marry? Why does Adoniyahu want to marry the Pelegesh? Why does Bathsheba agree to talk to Shlomo about it? Why is Shlomo so absolutely angry? And why is it a death penalty? And why doesn't Adoniyahu run away to the Mizbeach again? If it saved him once, why did it save him the second time? So that's the issue we're going to deal with. What exactly is going on with Pelegesh? Why does Adoniyahu have to die? And what kind of power exactly does Bathsheba have? And we'll find out next time something called the Queen Mum. The Queen Mum, also called the Gvira. We'll find out that the Gvira is the second most powerful person in the kingdom, and Bathsheba doesn't know it because she's the first Gvira. And we'll discuss that. We'll discuss that next time.
It was the Navi.
Yeah.
So didn't he give David the guidance?
But who listens to a rabbi? Well, you think it's only now that we don't pay attention to the rabbi? Back then also. Rabbi gets up and tells you, I'll tell you what God wants you to do.
Because
people don't pay attention.
It's clear that the Navi was beside Shlomo.
If you trust the Navi. And
sure.
Sometimes you don't. David obviously was not feeling, didn't feel like he was in a position to trust the Navi.
Okay.